probably heard the words trial penalty. Let me tell you what it is so that you can understand. If you're charged with a crime, say that carries a penalty of 1 to 10 years, and if you plead guilty, you'll get 1 year. But if you plead not guilty and you're found guilty, you'll get 10 years, 10 times the amount of prison time for the crime of exercising your right to trial by jury. That's not right. That's inconsistent with the Constitution. This is Alan Dershowitz, and you'll hear why our justice system is broken on the Dershowitz. Our criminal justice system is absolutely broken by any standard. Go back to the Bible, even an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. If you want to go from the Bible to the Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan, my object all sublime I shall achieve in time to let the punishment fit the crime, the punishment fit the crime. In America today, punishments don't fit the crime. They are arbitrary. From the time I started to practice law 55 years ago, the justice system has added a zero to virtually every punishment. What used to get one gets 10. What used to get two gets 20. What used to get three gets 30. Our prisons are filled. We have the most crowded prisons of any westernized democracy. We have the most people in prison of any westernized democracy. We're now beginning to execute people once again. And the system is totally arbitrary. Who gets executed depends not on the seriousness of the crime, but the quality of the lawyers, the money, the racial relationship between the perpetrator and the victim. Let me just tell you some terrible, terrible stories about the criminal justice system in an effort to try maybe to bring it to the attention of the proper authorities, and maybe we can do something about it. Maybe we can change it. I've spoken before about the trial penalty. I mentioned two cases in which people who I helped get commutations for were offered 7 to 10 year sentences. They went to trial because they thought they were innocent. They were convicted. They ended up getting 75 or 80 years in prison. The president commuted their sentence based on this terrible trial penalty. A case was brought to my attention just the other day in which somebody was offered a zero time, no time at all, minor crime, no time at all. But if that person decided to go to trial, they would make the penalty 25 years in prison, essentially life imprisonment for a person the age of the defendant in that case, and a fine of $25 million. How do you take a chance of going to trial in a close case? I mean, obviously, the purpose of our criminal justice system is to allow people to contest their guilt. The basic Bill of Rights is all about that, the right to trial by jury. And yet what's going on today is prosecutors are extorting guilty pleas. Yes, extorting guilty pleas. If you don't plead guilty, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison, and your wife's going to get prosecuted, and your son's going to get prosecuted, and your business partner is going to get prosecuted. When you're faced with that kind of prospect, of course, many innocent people and many people who are in the gray area between innocence and guilt, not totally and completely innocent of everything, but certainly not guilty of the crime for which they're charged, plead guilty because they feel they have no option. Now, you may argue, well, it's not really a punishment for going to trial. It's a reward for not going to trial. What's the difference between a punishment and a reward? A punishment is what you get if you do the thing, go to trial, and a reward is what you get if you don't do the thing. Let's put it in the context of voting. What if somebody came to you and said, you know, you have a right to vote, but I'd rather you not vote because you're a Democrat or Republican, whatever, and this is Georgia and we have to control the Senate. So I would like to pay you $10,000 for not voting. Person would go to jail. Or if they said, I'm going to fine you $10,000 for voting, that would clearly be illegal. Well, what's the difference? The right to a trial is as central to democratic governance as the right to vote. And you can't buy a person's right to vote, and you shouldn't be able to buy a person's right to trial or punish him or her if they exercise that right to trial. So we have to do something about this. You know, our whole criminal justice system is premised on the assumption that 90% of the people charged will plead guilty because of the coercive effects of the trial penalty. If everybody decided to plead not guilty, the system would come to a halt. Indeed, some years ago, when the New York Legal Aid Agency wanted a strike because they weren't given sufficient pay or access to their defendants or reasonable funds to hire investigators for their defendants, instead of just walking off the job, which nobody could have cared, what they did is they decided to plead all their clients not guilty, and they brought the system to a halt. The system is geared to 10% of the people going to trial. If you get that 10% up to 20, 30, 40%, the system grinds to a halt. There aren't enough judges, there aren't enough prosecutors, there aren't enough courtrooms. So what's the answer to that? The answer to that is to make fewer things crimes. We have so many things on the books that shouldn't be crimes, that should be civil. You go and you settle it financially. Crime should be really reserved for the most heinous of actions. Obviously, anything violent, anything that endangers people should be a crime, and obviously massive white-collar Bernie Madoff should be crimes. But I have so many cases that I've seen where it's really a civil dispute between people. It could be settled financially, and yet the government decides to bring charges or drug charges. You know, how many people are in jail for marijuana-related charges? Now marijuana is legal in many, many states, and yet the prisons are still filled with people who are there because of their involvement with marijuana. So I think if we eliminated the trial penalty or reduced it, I'm willing to settle. I'm a reasonable person. Double the penalty. Double the penalty. Instead of 1 year, you get 2 years. Instead of five, you get 10. Double. But no more than double. No more than double. The impact would still be more people would go to trial and more people would get acquitted as well. Remember, it's better for 10 guilty to go free than for one innocent to be wrongly confined. And we do have people who today are wrongly confined. Our prisons are filled with innocent people and with people who are at least arguably innocent or on the margins of innocence or guilt. So I think it would do a great service to the system if we eliminated or modified the trial penalty. I know that President Trump's interested in this, and he's given already a couple of commutations based on that. I know he has more cases pending based on the trial penalty. Some of them I have brought to his attention and to the attention of people in the White House. I hope he acts on them, and I hope he sends a message that the reason he's doing this is because the trial penalty is unconstitutional. Back in 1966, I was a kid lawyer. I was 28 years old, an assistant professor at Harvard. I filed my first certiorari petition to the United States Supreme Court. It challenged the trial penalty. My client was sentenced to double or triple, not one of these outrageously excessive sentences, for a white-collar crime that if he had pled guilty to it, he would have gotten a half or a third the sentence. So I challenged it, brought it to the Supreme Court. My memory, and I think it's correct, is that I think we got three votes for certiorari. You need four, but we didn't get the fourth. And I have been fighting against the trial penalty now, what's that, 55 years, my God. That's a long, long time, or at least 50 years, a half a century. I've been fighting against the trial penalty, and I'll continue to fight against it because it totally distorts our system. Look, it goes back to the Bible. If you plead guilty, you get a less harsh punishment. Adam and Eve confessed their guilt, and they got a lesser punishment. Cain, you know, am I my brother's keeper? He didn't quite confess his guilt, and he ended up being a real estate developer. Maybe that's punishment enough. But the concept that if you plead guilty, you get a lesser penalty goes back a long time. But the idea that you get a penalty of 10 times the amount you would have gotten for going to trial, that's new, that's novel, that's the American way. And sometimes it even involves life and death. That is, the government offers murderers life imprisonment if they plead guilty and the death penalty if they don't. Nobody should ever have to choose between life and death on the one hand and the right to trial by jury. You know, in old traditional laws, you couldn't plead guilty to a capital offense because if you did, you were committing suicide, essentially. Well, today we allow guilty pleas to capital offenses, But we punish people by the death penalty who don't submit a guilty plea. And so I think our system is in terrible, terrible need of reform. Beyond the trial penalty, we also have the problem of bail. So many people today are in prison because they simply can't afford to pay the bail, or even if they can afford it, they're not given a bail. Remember, the Constitution says that excessive bail shall not be required, and there is a presumption of innocence. So when a person's arrested, they must be presumed innocent. Why are they in jail if they're arrested? Why shouldn't they be at home waiting for trial? Well, the answer is maybe they'll run away, or maybe they'll commit new crimes. But if you have somebody who is not going to commit new crimes and has a real stake in the trial and is not going to run away, they should be freed on bail. They should be allowed to wait for their trial at home. Consider the case of Ghislaine Maxwell. Now, some of you say, I have a stake in that. I know Ghislaine Maxwell. I don't know her well. I knew her when she was a friend of Jeffrey Epstein. My wife spent time with her. My daughter spent time with her. We never saw her do anything wrong. I'm not going to comment on the merits of the case, but I am going to comment on the fact that the trial judge the other day, a very good trial judge, somebody with an extraordinary reputation, denied her bail for the second time, even though her family, her husband, her friends were willing to put up in excess of $20 million. $20 million. Talk about excessive bail. And were prepared to spend whatever it took to assure that she could not flee. She would be living in an apartment, presumably with guards at the door. Let's assume it's, a 40th floor apartment. I don't know the facts, but surely it could be that. A 40 floor apartment with one exit, one door. She's not going to go out the window, and she can't leave the front door if there are armed guards there. Her passport's been taken away. Her ability to travel is impossible. Her face is well known around the world, and yet she's been denied bail and has to spend the time during which she's presumed innocent in a federal detention center under suicide watch because they're afraid that what Jeffrey Epstein may have done, she would do. There's no reason for her not to be at home awaiting trial. One of the arguments that's made is, well, but she's rich. She can afford to have guards. What about the poor people? Well, the poor people should be let out too, and maybe the government should provide for security. But you don't punish rich people because poor people don't have access to the same freedoms. If you applied that to medicine, you'd have the worst medical practices for everybody. Rich people can afford better medicine than poor people. That doesn't mean that rich people should be denied the right to have good medicine. Rich people can afford better education. In a free market society, you don't punish the rich because they have worked hard or maybe inherited the money. It doesn't matter how they've gotten it as long as it's legitimate and legal. And in this case, she was prepared to put up this $20-odd million or more to be able to spend her presumed innocent time at home. She should have been granted that, and I hope she still will. They're just punishing her before she's been convicted. It's Alice in Wonderland. Alice in Wonderland, we talked about the Queen saying, we'll punish first and try later. That's what happens in the criminal justice system. And by the way, it's related to the trial penalty. Because if you deny somebody bail and you put them in a hellhole and tell them they're going to spend another year there, but if they plead guilty, maybe they can get out now. My son was a legal aid lawyer in New York for several years, and his clients were often offered that kind of deal. You're in jail. You're going to stay on Rikers Island, which is hell. I've been there. But if you plead guilty today, you'll get time served and you'll be home tomorrow. Of course you're going to plead guilty whether you did it or not. And then I want to mention one final case because it's a case I was close to and I care deeply about. Many of you probably don't know the name Jonathan Pollard. Jonathan Pollard was an American naval civilian intelligence person who took material that was classified and gave it to the Israeli government. He was properly prosecuted. That is a crime. Nobody has the right to engage in civil disobedience. He had his reasons for doing so. He thought that the material should have been turned over to Israel and that Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense at the time, who was very anti-Israel, broke an agreement with Israel and didn't turn over this material that could have prevented acts of terrorism and acts of aggression against Israel. So he engaged in an act of civil disobedience for which he was appropriately punished. He made a deal, a plea bargain. His deal was if he pleaded guilty and if he helped with the damage assessment, which is very important, and didn't challenge the system in any way and cooperated fully, he would get a prison term consistent with what others have gotten, but not life imprisonment. He would get a prison term, and the usual term for spying for an ally is 7 to 8 years. An Egyptian person got that. A Polish person got that. There'd never been a double-digit sentence for somebody who had spied for an ally before. So he pleaded guilty on those assurances, and then a secret memorandum was sent by the same Caspar Weinberger, and it was filled with lies, just filled with overstatements, exaggerations, and lies. And as the result of that, the judge basically broke the agreement with the government and gave him life imprisonment. And it was challenged. I was one of his lawyers. It was a very, very interesting argument on appeal. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg cast the deciding vote against him. And his sentence of life imprisonment was upheld. He then served over 30 years in prison and was eventually paroled, as he should have been. I tried hard to get him a pardon or a commutation for many, many, many years. I tried with several American presidents, and President Clinton came close to it. He wanted to do it, but the head of the CIA, George Tenet, said he would resign in protest if a commutation was given to Pollard. So the president didn't do that. And just yesterday, finally, he was allowed to go to Israel, where he now is. He was given a low-key welcome by Israel because he had helped Israel, but he had caused tremendous problems in the relationship between Israel and the United States. And he's now an old man. His wife has a very serious cancer, which he's being treated for. He has served long enough, and I hope he'll be able to live his life. I worked very hard to secure his release and his ability to go to Israel. I may have played a small behind-the-scenes role in the ultimate resolution, but the credit goes largely to him and his wife, who fought continuously for their ability to go to Israel. He was greeted by the Prime Minister of Israel, but again, in a low-keyed way. He's not a hero for what he did. He's a hero for what he endured, a massively excessive sentence for a crime that probably deserved 7 and 8 years, and instead he served more than 30 in prison. I visited him in prison, and he was in a very difficult place. He was right next to crime lords. He was in maximum security. And so I wish him well on his, what he regards, his return to Israel. He basically believes he is an Israeli at heart. And, there's always the threat that people will believe in dual loyalty. It's a canard. American Jews are loyal to America first. Yes, many of us feel strongly about Israel in the same way that Irish Americans feel about their heritage, Italian Americans about their heritage, Greek Americans about their heritage, African Americans about their heritage. Jews are no different. In fact, probably Jews are more critical, many of them, of Israel than many other ethnic groups are of their countries of heritage or origin. So I think that chapter is now behind us, but it reflects again a major flaw in our criminal justice system. These zeros being added to sentences, this trial penalty, it makes us look so foolish in the eyes of the world, and justly so. We are an unjust country when it comes to our criminal justice system. We can do better. We lead the world in so many areas, and we are last among Western democracies when it comes to letting the punishment fit the crime, criminal justice, and fairness to the accused. So I'm interested in hearing your views. You know, Americans are tough on crime. That's understandable. As a citizen, I'm tough on crime. As a criminal defense lawyer, obviously, I defend my criminals. But as a citizen, I don't support criminals. I don't admire criminals. I want to see them justly punished. But the key word is just. The Bible commands Justice, justice must thou pursue. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. It was my own bar mitzvah portion where I read from the Torah, and I read those words, justice, justice must you pursue. And why is justice repeated twice? Well, once is the core of technical justice. If you've committed a crime, you should be punished. But the second justice reflects compassion, reform, rehabilitation, the idea that people can change. And I hope that I live long enough to see our system of justice reflect both technical justice and compassion, and having the punishments fit the crime and the criminal, and not excessive punishments for the crime of going to trial. That's my view on our criminal justice system. I'm interested in your views on the criminal justice system. So please call The Dirt Show and let me hear what you have to say. Let me get your questions and let me try to conduct a dialogue with you about our criminal justice system and other issues that we've covered on The Dirt Show. So now let's turn to our viewers and listeners' questions. Our first call today is from Mark.
I'd like to see a show on why you persist to be a Democrat, or at least call yourself one. And you know, when I listen to you, much of what you have to say is opposite, at least the way I think, where you fit more along the lines of the conservative. You know, at least the current conservative party that we've seen over the last couple few years, and so I just wonder how you persist to support a group that does the things like we see with the suppression of speech and various other things. You know, it seems like, you know, they have an army that ignores truth, and you know, as Biden puts it, you know, they really don't even understand what the truth is when you listen to some of what he's said over the years, and you know, would prefer their mocked up version of the truth rather than the actual truth on things.
Thank you for your question. Earlier this year, I wrote a book called The Case for Liberalism in an Age of Extremism, or Why I Left the Left but Couldn't Join the Right. And let me explain why I continue to be a Democrat. I support a woman's right to choose. The Republican Party does not. I support gay rights and gay marriage. The Republican Party does not. I support reasonable gun control. The Republican Party does not. I support health care for as many people as possible, consistent with our economic capabilities. The Republican Party does not. I support more equitable, fair taxation. I support separation of church and state. I support the typical liberal agenda. If I were living in England, I would be a member of the Conservative Party today, because the Conservative Party in England supports all of those liberal issues. They're just more conservative on fiscal issues and on foreign policy issues, and I can join them on that. But in the United States, the Republican Party has been captive often by evangelical right-wingers who oppose social policies that I agree with. Look, I hate what the Democrat extremists are doing on college campuses, free speech. I'll give you an example. Just today, I read that a Black Lives Matter related group in England, but nonetheless related to Black Lives Matter, is calling for a blacklist, literally a blacklist, of anybody who's regarded as a racist or who's expressed racist views or expressed racist sympathies or engaged in micro or macro aggressions. And that list would be sent to employers all over the country with the notion, don't hire them. It's pure McCarthyism. Pure McCarthyism. And it comes from people on the left. So I'm not a leftist. I am a liberal. A liberal can be conservative, or liberal can be more moderate. There's no inconsistency between having liberal values and also conservative values, as the Conservative Party in Israel proves. If the Conservative Party and Republican Party in the United States moved more toward the social policy issues that I support, I could easily imagine myself shifting parties. But I can't belong to a party that has in its platform opposition to these basic liberties like a woman's right to choose and gay marriage. Also, I'm opposed to capital punishment, and the Republican Party seems to favor capital punishment. So I'm remaining a Democrat. When the Democrats came close to nominating somebody with a history of bigotry, I said I would quit the Democratic Party if he were elected chairman. He was not elected chairman. I will not remain a Democrat if it becomes a party of AOC, a party of the extremists, a party of the squad. But I will remain a Democrat as long as I can have some influence within the Democratic Party of marginalizing the extreme left. Maybe I can have some influence in helping the Republican Party move closer to what was once Eisenhower Republicanism, Rockefeller Republicanism, even in some ways Reagan Republicanism. But I think we're seeing a movement to the right by the Republican Party, which is not something that I can embrace. But thanks for your great question. Our next call is from Michelle in Los Angeles.
Alan, I am calling to comment on your show, on which aired on Tuesday, and the discussion that you had on democracy denial. I am also Jewish, and I am disgusted by what seems to be so many liberal, educated, articulate Jews who continue to use the death of our people, the grotesque death of our people that happened during the Holocaust, to score political points. We are done. We are done with this. It is not acceptable, and it should be condemned on every front. Thanks, Alan.
Look, you may have stated it a little bit more strongly than I would state it, because these are my friends. We were talking about Norm Eisen and Deborah Lipstadt, but I think they overdid it. I do agree with you. I don't think the Holocaust should be used as an analogy or as anything comparable to what's going on in the world today. When you do that, you minimize the Holocaust. The Holocaust was unique in world history, and so please, I urge my friends Norman and Deborah and others, do not use analogies to the Holocaust. Do not use analogies to Holocaust denial or Nazi Germany. Make your argument. You can make a powerful argument against what you call democracy denial. That's fine. Just don't make the analogy. It just is not appropriate. And I agree with the thrust of the caller's call. Our next call is from Robert in Florida.
On the Trump's actually mentioning this is an act of war and a fight to the death, his words, I got to say that it's amazing that the media, the lawyers that are all over YouTube and so forth, won't touch that with a 100-foot pole. They won't even acknowledge that this stuff was said. And it's just amazing, because you talk about magnificent law, the fact that Trump has gone every court in the country, and they've shut the thing legally and never even looked at the evidence and refused to look at the evidence, refused to let the evidence be shown. And the founders of this nation, with divine intervention, say that the right to bear arms is to protect against this an invasion of both foreign and domestic enemies. And when a president says it's an act of war, it's a call. It's a call. Have a nice day. And again, I'd like to talk to you. Thank you.
I appreciate your call, but I fundamentally disagree. The right to bear arms should not be used to engage in violence based on a democratic election. If you disagree with the election, take it to court. Take it to court of public opinion. Run again in 2024. Rail against the machine. Do whatever you want, but don't invoke your right to bear arms. The right to bear arms is designed to defend and protect against other people bearing arms. It's not designed to challenge the results of elections. Imagine if the Democrats had said the same thing in 2000 when they thought the election was taken from them by the Supreme Court. Resort to arms is not something in a democratic modern country that we should use except in cases of literal invasion, where we have to defend ourselves and protect ourselves against the use of arms by other people. We have other methods. We have a court. The Supreme Court considered the case. It rejected it with three votes by the three justices appointed by President Trump. I happen to disagree with the decision. I think they should have taken the case. But when you disagree with a decision, you don't go get your rifle. That's just not the American way. So I understand your anger, but I disagree with your remedy. Our last call is from Roger in Massachusetts.
Hi, this is Roger from Massachusetts. So I just want to ask you what role religion still plays in your life, because I know you were raised an Orthodox Jew, but I listened to one of your speeches critiquing religion. So I think you're aligned with the new atheist movement, especially since you praised Sam Harris's book and you've critiqued the religious right. So would you say you're aligned with the new atheist movement? And at this point, I think, and I would ask if you agree, if the religious right has lost the culture war, they failed to overturn the Supreme Court case on abortion and gay marriage, and do you still believe in God, or do you just, like, glean wisdom from the Bible, even though the Bible has a lot of barbaric phrases, and recognize that the Bible was a work of humans? Thank you.
It's a good question. You know, it's very personal, but I'm happy to try to respond. I'm a skeptic. I'm not an atheist. Atheists are much too sure of their point of view. I just don't know. I'm not sure. I will die a skeptic. My last words will not be words of certainty or conclusion. They'll be words of skepticism and doubt. Doubt and skepticism have permeated my life. I'm a skeptic about science. I'm a skeptic about religion. I'm a skeptic about many systems of morality. I challenge everything. It's just in my nature to challenge everything. So I guess you can say I'm agnostic in some ways. I go to synagogue. I pray. I don't expect my prayers to be specifically answered. I'm a traditional Jew. I love my heritage. I love the Bible. I read the Bible. I've written two books about the Bible, The Genesis of Justice and a book called Abraham, the world's first but certainly not last Jewish lawyer, the history of Abraham in the book of Genesis. So my views on religion are complicated. I don't buy Sam Harris's atheism or the atheism of others who are strident. I'm certainly not critical of those who are deep believers and have faith. People I respect enormously have a deep faith in God and are serious, serious intellectuals. I'm an intellectual too, but a skeptic about everything, including atheism and including traditional religion. I do think that religion is often misused but so is atheism, for social purposes. For example, those who cite religion to refuse to take vaccinations are abusing religion. There's nothing in any religious tradition except perhaps, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses or Christian Scientists, but mainstream religions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, other mainstream religions, encourage vaccination and taking measures to promote health, but some argue the other way, and I think they're just wrong, and they're misusing religion to make points that really derive from other value systems. So skepticism, that's my religion, being a skeptic about everything. And by the way, if you're going to have to pick a religion to adhere to while being a skeptic, Judaism's a pretty good one, because it encourages questioning everything. The Talmud is filled with questions and doubts. The Jewish Bible, Abraham arguing with God, Moses arguing with God, Job challenging God. It's Ecclesiastes. Many of the books of the Jewish Bible raise more questions than they answer. So I feel comfortable being a Jewish skeptic. Thanks for your question. See you all in future days on The Durst Show. Keep your questions coming. I love engaging in dialogue with you, and I love your questions, whether I agree with them or not. They always make me think on The Durst Show.